Welcome to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a serialized novel by Samuel Ligon, published for the first time in The Inlander and broadcast by Spokane Public Radio. Miller Kane is made possible by Sprint and The Inlander. Previously on Miller Kane, Lizzie is stuck in jail after shooting her estranged husband, Connor Callahan, who sustained only minimal injuries. Connor had long been out of the picture, but he recently learned that their 8-year-old daughter, Carlene, will soon inherit the massive Callahan family fortune that Connor believes is rightfully his. While she's in jail, Lizzie has asked Miller to take care of Carlene, and he's driving to Washington State now to pick her up. Miller's not sure how long he'll need to keep Carlene safe, and he hopes Lizzie's lawyer, Campbell, can help.
Chapter 1, Part 5. Miller made it to Moab before stopping to sleep. Was on the road again by 7 with a thermos of coffee and a box of donuts, 2 apple fritters, an old fashioned, 2 maple bars, and 4 turnovers, mumbleberry and cherry. Not as good as cigarettes, maybe, but something to serve as a reward for each 100 miles driven. "Take it to court," he told Lizzie after Connor came back a few weeks ago. "Make the custody clear. No way is a judge giving him anything." Miller was still in Cumberland then, tiptoeing around Hefner. He'd been trying to brush the man off for days, saying he was booked, but Hefner kept popping up at the Marriott, collaring Miller at vigils. "Get the custody straightened out," he told Lizzie. "Connor's been a deadbeat, even if he is rich. And get a restraining order." "Oh, please," Lizzie said. "How many of your shooters had restraining orders against them?" 2 that Miller knew of, Daniel Phillips in Delaware, 14 dead, and Nathan Cole in New Mexico, 7. "Nobody knows what Connor's capable of," Lizzie said, "though we certainly know what he's incapable of. Carlene hardly even remembers him, doesn't miss him at all. She never even knew him, so it's not like she's been deprived of anything, except something that would have been bad for her. I mean, you've been more of a father to her than he ever was." As if Miller didn't know that. Now, as he drove toward the kid, he needed a plan, some way to structure their time together. But for how long? 2 days? A week? 6 months? According to the radio, the entire West was on fire, most of it anyway, a hell of a lot of it. And just south of Provo, he finally smelled the smoke. He kept driving, pulled over in Twin Falls for a nap. The smoke was thicker in Idaho, the sun's light dull and diffuse, colorless it seemed, his eyes itching and burning from the fires reported in BC and Montana, the North Cascades and Eastern Oregon, even out on the peninsula. He'd never heard a fire on the peninsula. A small one, maybe, but not burning for days like this. He woke mid-afternoon and got back on the road, grinding out the miles. Campbell called and said Carlene wouldn't be ready till noon tomorrow because she and Kara were camping. Lizzie was doing all right, he said, all things considered. They'd know more next week. "But how does it look?" Miller said, "based on what you know so far." "Hard to tell," Campbell said. "There's a lot to learn." "How about initial impressions?" Miller said. "It's odd for me to talk with you about this," Campbell said. "I know you paid me." "We're practically family," Miller said, "me and Lizzie." "And she said to tell you everything," Campbell said. Miller waited. Was the man really going to give him nothing? According to Lizzie, Campbell said, Connor didn't have a weapon. Not that she could see, anyway. "But he probably lunged at her," Miller said. "Maybe," Campbell said. "He definitely scared her. But it happened out front, and there was a witness across the street." "Friedlander," Miller said, "an incorrigible drunk. The man's completely unreliable." "But the thing is," Campbell said, "just real broadly here, regarding the law, if you're not facing deadly force, you can't respond with deadly force." "Is Connor dead?" Miller said. "No," Campbell said. "Hurt bad?" Miller said. "I think you know what I'm talking about," Campbell said. It didn't seem like Lizzie's force had been at all deadly if Connor wasn't even hurt bad. "I'm just saying," Campbell said, "broadly, in this kind of situation with deadly force, you're probably going to face some serious charges." "But specifically," Miller said, "regarding her case, once all the circumstances become clear, Right, Campbell said. There will be a lot of factors. The prosecutor will be talking with Mr. Callahan. I'll be shocked if we don't see a restraining order in a few days. Against who? Ms. James. Lizzie? She did shoot him, Mr. Kane. But he deserved it, Miller said. What about her getting a restraining order against him? What about everybody getting a restraining order against everybody else? We're talking about that, Campbell said. We're just going to have to be patient and see what comes out at the indictment. We'll know more then. Sound good? No, Miller thought. It did not sound good. He hung up feeling like he'd learned nothing, and that the nothing he'd learned was all bad. The smoke was a blanket over Baker City. He stopped for dinner, then drove on through the Blue Mountains to the Tri-Cities, over through Yakima and up, before finally stopping in Ellensburg for the night. A few years ago, he'd lived in one place, Spokane, a regular person with a regular job and a side job, too, contributing to a line of history textbooks. His specialty had been set-aside sections, writing that went into a little more depth than the broad, boring sweep of the bulk of each book. 900 words on the Whiskey Rebellion, 1,700 on Lewis and Clark and the Corps of Discovery, 600 words on Frederick Douglass. George Sampson, his editor, had recently reminded Miller, again, that he owed such material for an 11th grade text. Miller's contribution was to be brief biographies of notable Americans to be included in set-aside sections woven throughout the book, each of which would be titled Famous American's Name, : Hero or Villain. Miller thought the idea sounded okay in principle, but it would become idiotic in practice, because while the feature would pretend to deal in ambiguity, the publisher would be afraid to challenge too many students or parents or school boards or mayors or other Americans. The publisher would want to reinforce whatever mythology the current moment called for in the most school districts or states, depending on who was buying. Not that it had ever been any different, probably, but Miller was done with history, with teaching. He'd signed the contract 5 years ago as part of a 3-book deal, 2 of which he'd delivered before he got on the road. He'd been waiting for George to dump him from the hero-villain project for over a year now, or to ask for some money back, but here in Ellensburg, Miller wondered if this project might be just what he needed to create structure for his time with Carlene. He wrote George to tell him he was ready to start work on the book, but only if he could pick the heroes and villains. It was midnight in Texas, where the publisher was based, but George wrote back right away. We want you to follow your passion here, he said, within reason, of course. We want you to bring these stories to life for the kids, he said, almost like fiction. Miller poured a finger of whiskey, drank it at the table. Was it really this easy to jump back into regular life? Not that he was jumping into anything. Whatever he was doing, he certainly wouldn't be staying. This was just a side gig, a job for him and Carlene to do to give their lives structure while he pretended to be a parent. He started a list of heroes and villains, figures he might be interested in. Elizabeth Custer, John Brown, Sacagawea, MLK, the lobotomized Kennedy sister, Frank Lloyd Wright, Muddy Waters, Eleanor Roosevelt's lovers, platonic or not. At Christmas, Miller had given Carlene the Little House books. Maybe they'd head to Laura's farm in Missouri. He pulled out the atlas to help shape his list. Narcissa Whitman would be perfect, so close to home. They could visit the Whitman mission in Walla Walla, maybe hit the Pendleton Roundup if the timing was right. What was more American than a rodeo? Maybe they'd make some stops along the Oregon Trail, find out whatever there was to see there, if anything remained. He could read her Uncle Jim's diary from 1862, make Uncle Jim a hero villain. Carlene would help with the list. She'd love it. They both would. He added Buffalo Bill, Black Elk, Margaret Sanger. They'd never let him write that one. Frank Sinatra's mother. Why not? Charles Manson. No, too scary. But he was going to follow his passion just like George requested, and Carlene's. They'd separate the heroes from the villains. One job could rest while another began. He'd be a good surrogate parent, too, even if he didn't know what he was doing. What mattered was that he loved her, always had and always would. Lizzie knew that. So did Carlene. Connor probably, too. Not that Miller cared what Connor knew. Miller often wondered if Carlene might be his. Not that it mattered much. Not that it mattered at all. He'd be her father whether there was blood or not.
You've been listening to Miller Kane, A True and Exact History, a novel by Samuel Ligon, published in weekly installments by The Inlander, with archived audio at SpokanePublicRadio.org/MillerKane. Our theme music is by Indian Goat. I'm your producer, Chris Messini. Join us next week for the latest episode of Miller Kane.